Released concurrently with the Drudge Manifesto was a book by Nightline's Ted Koppel. Koppel got a Times book review and appearances on The Today Show and Larry King Live to promote his book, which barely made the list for 1 week. The one near exception to the rule that only liberals are eligible for mind-boggling advances is David Brock, who received an enormous advance for his book on Hillary Clinton. This was hardly undeserved inasmuch as his previous book had spent 11 weeks on the Times bestseller list, while being slammed by the critics. But between the advance and the publication of the book, Brock became a liberal. His book crashed and burned when it was spurned by conservative readers. Thus, the Brock exception merely demonstrates the axiom that conservatives read books and liberals don't, an unalterable fact that will never, ever be acknowledged by mainstream publishers. Though publishers incessantly complain that big advances are often not repaid in book sales, they refuse to acknowledge a half-century of marketing research demonstrating that conservative books tend to sell quite well, while liberal books require major blockbuster promotion merely to avoid publishing disasters. Liberals compete for advances in the millions of dollars. Conservatives are happy to be published at all. In addition to lucrative advances for books that don't sell, liberal writers can always be assured of a position on the op-ed page of any of various major newspapers, where a writer need be popular only with his editors. Liberals succeed by impressing an oligopoly of fellow liberals, rather than winning in the marketplace of ideas. It would be interesting to compare liberals and conservatives on a grid. One axis for number of words published in elite newspapers, and the other axis for weeks on a bestseller list. In reviews that are often as compelling as their books, unsuccessful liberal authors use their premier positions in the pages of the monopoly media to describe best-selling conservative authors as follows. Windbags, no talent hacks, and laughably inept flops. That's the Washington Post's Tom Shales, none of whose books ever made any bestseller list, on Bernard Goldberg's number one book, Bias. Smear artists who are repulsed by female sexuality. That's Frank Rich, whose book Ghostlight was a mid-list failure, on David Brock's best-selling The Real Anita Hill. Writers of hatchet books. That's Newsweek columnist Jonathan Alter, whose books were commercial failures, on Barbara Olson's best-selling Hell to Pay. And finally, a blowhard recycling his radio monologues in a rant of opinions, gags, and insults, with a few facts or near facts, who applies ad hominem ad nauseam, unsubtle slobberings and slaverings, sprinkled in like the meat in last week's stew. That's New York Times book reviewer Walter Goodman, whose own books flopped, on best-selling champion Rush Limbaugh. Conservative books may be snubbed in the elite media, hidden by bookstores, and regularly spurned by major publishers. But at least with books, we know who the public wants to read. While publishing houses are understandably wary of conservative books that instantly skyrocket onto the New York Times bestseller list, the evidence suggests that they are a bit over-anxious to publish liberals. In the rush to provide the public with yet more liberal bilge, editors apparently dispense with fact-checking. Books that become publishing scandals by virtue of phony research, invented facts, or apocryphal stories invariably grind political axes for the left. There may be publishing frauds that are apolitical, but it's hard to think of a single hoax book written by a conservative. Perhaps the most famous left-wing hoax was I, Rigoberta Menchú. Menchú's purported account of her torment at the hands of the Guatemalan military was uncritically accepted by the left and used as a bludgeon against the Reagan administration for sending aid to Guatemala. Menchú herself met with State Department officials to urge an end to American aid to Guatemala. Her alleged autobiography won the Nobel Peace Prize, was translated into 12 languages, inspired 15,000 scholarly papers, and was required reading at colleges across America. Menchú was the recipient of 14 honorary doctorates. And then it was exposed as a hoax by anthropologist and Guatemalan expert David Stoll of Middlebury College, who examined archival material and interviewed survivors of the events described by Menchú. He found her book was a fantasy, an utter fraud from beginning to end. Thus, for example, on the very first page of her Nobel Prize-winning book, Menchú claimed to be an uneducated, illiterate peasant. Indeed, the book had to be translated from tapes of Menchú's oral history. It turned out, however, Menchú had attended prestigious boarding schools run by nuns. She claimed to have engaged in arduous low-wage labor in coffee and cotton fields as a child. In fact, she belonged to a relatively prosperous farming family. She vividly described being forced to watch family members starve or burn to death. These events, too, never occurred. As one of Menchu's native countrymen described it, the book is one lie after another and she knows it. Stoll's refutation of Menchu's account was later confirmed by the New York Times. Another prize-winning hoax was the anti-gun, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture by Michael Belleil. He claimed to have reviewed more than 10,000 probate and criminal records to make the stunning claim that only about 14% of men owned guns in colonial America, and most of those guns were unusable. America's gun culture, he claimed, was an invented tradition. The jacket flap on his book boasted, "This is the NRA's worst nightmare." Neither his publisher nor the reviewers needed to know more. Belleil's conclusion was instantly and uncritically embraced by the elite media despite questions raised about his research by Second Amendment scholars such as Gary Kleck, Glenn Reynolds, and Don Cates. Arming America was granted a major pre-release promotion in the New York Times Week in Review section entitled The Lock and Load Myth, A Disarming Heritage. The article boasted, "Mr. Belleil's book may change the terms of the debate." Upon its publication, the book was giddily reviewed in the Times by Gary Wills, who gushed, "Belleil has dispersed the darkness that covered the gun's early history in America." He praised Belleil for marshaling overwhelming evidence that proved America's view of the gun was a superstition, as pervasive as any that affected Native Americans in the 17th century. But after a year of praise and awards and glorious press for Arming America, it turned out Belleil had fabricated his research. Other scholars had tried to review Belleil's research, but the data didn't match. Often the records he claimed to have reviewed didn't exist. There were literally hundreds of errors and invented facts in Belleil's book. He claimed to have reviewed San Francisco probate records for 1849 to 1859. It turned out all those records had been destroyed by a fire in the earthquake of 1906. When questioned about his research, Belleil said he couldn't respond because his notes had been lost in a flood of his office at Emory University. Other faculty members found that claim incredible. When factual errors were found on his website, he claimed it had been hacked. When a sympathetic colleague offered to search through the probate records on his own time and duplicate Belleil's work in order to defend him, Belleil never returned the call. Another liberal publishing fraud, Fortunate Son, George W. Bush and the Making of an American President, was pulled from the shelves shortly after publication, when the author, whose book relied on his personal credibility, turned out to be a convicted felon. The author, Jim Hatfield, made the extravagant claim that he had nailed down Bush's alleged cocaine conviction, a long-rumored incident that had eluded scores of talented and battle-worn journalists. St. Martin's Press released the book just as George Bush was embarking on his presidential campaign in 1999. It raised no flags at St. Martin's Press that top-flight investigative reporters from the mainstream media, where 9 out of 10 reporters voted for Clinton, had unearthed no evidence of the purported cocaine bust. An unknown, unpublished author, who refused to divulge his sources, struck New York liberals as completely credible. He claimed to have the goods on George Bush. Though the author of Fortunate Son was not known in publishing circles, it turned out he was well known to law enforcement. He was a 2-time convicted felon, still on parole for a solicitation of murder conviction. For his most recent criminal conviction, Hatfield had paid a hitman $5,000 to kill his female supervisor because, according to a witness, he was enraged about the fact that this incompetent woman was his supervisor. The Washington Post described the careful vetting process for a book that would accuse a presidential candidate of having a criminal record. Nobody at St. Martin's Press had met the author until he arrived for the abortive book promotion last October. No fact-checking was done. Nobody insisted on knowing Hatfield's sources or on securing supporting material for his sensational charges. Hatfield claimed the Bush family had purged the supposed cocaine bust from the record, but could produce not a shred of evidence. He had no date for the conviction, no arresting officer, no judge, no county, no general description of his, quote, sources. Slate magazine soon caught Hatfield describing one of his alleged sources as spitting tobacco into the, quote, ever-present styrofoam cup, contradicting an earlier claim that he had talked to his sources only by telephone. Not only that, but the Times proclaimed, "Perhaps if politicians were more forthcoming, they would be smeared less." It was Bush's fault that a convicted felon was libeling him. The New York Times rushed in with a defense of the ex-con author, noting that novelists John Bunyan, Cervantes, and Dostoevsky all did time. St. Martin's withdrew the book when Hatfield's solicitation of murder conviction was revealed. Hatfield had received a $25,000 advance, not huge, but quite a bit more than the typical advance paid to first-time conservative authors whose books end up on the bestseller list. One of the more lascivious stink bomb books was Kitty Kelly's 1991 Nancy Reagan, The Unauthorized Biography. Kelly accused both Reagans of having affairs and of smoking pot in the governor's mansion in the late 60s. The former First Lady was said to have carried on a long-term affair with Frank Sinatra in full view of the White House staff. Her husband awarded Sinatra the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1985. Kelly was paid what was, at the time, said to be the largest book advance ever paid for a nonfiction book. Kelly's book was almost entirely unsourced, and the sources Kelly did provide repeatedly denied her claims. As George Will wrote in the Washington Post, Kelly's book exhibited raw malice, crudeness, mendacity, and ignorance. Yet her book was treated as hard news at the New York Times in the heavy-breathing account of then-reporter Maureen Dowd. A few years hence, Dowd would be hooting that the Star Report demonstrated only Ken Starr's, quote, cravings for ecstasy. Not only was the Star Report concerned with felonies rather than idle gossip, it was at least based on proven facts rather than unsubstantiated gossip. But the Star Report was, quote, pornography, though what Clinton did wasn't sex. Kitty Kelly's purple prose about the Reagan's alleged sexual tryst was literally front-page news at the New York Times. In addition to a bumper crop of vicious and unsourced books defaming conservatives, books by feminists are often a treasure trove of invented statistics. Confirming the feminists' well-known facility with numbers, Naomi Wolf absurdly claimed in The Beauty Myth that 150,000 women die each year from anorexia. Comparing death by anorexia to the Holocaust, Wolf fumed. How would America react to the mass self-immolation by hunger of its favorite sons? Gloria Steinem repeated the alleged anorexia statistic in her book, Revolution from Within. Christina Hoff Sommers, author of the 1992 book, Who Stole Feminism, went to the trouble to call the National Center for Health Statistics to find out that there are approximately 100 deaths from anorexia each year. Noting that anorexia occurs in an extremely narrow demographic, affecting almost entirely white, upper-middle-class, overachieving women, Hoff Sommers wryly observed that if 150,000 women had been dying every year from anorexia, at Wellesley College graduation, you would need to have ambulances on hand the way you do at major sports events. Now consider, only about 2 million people die of all causes in the United States each year. Auto accidents claim the lives of about 40,000 people annually, including pedestrians. How on earth did the purported 150,000 anorexia deaths slip past the editors, to say nothing of the authors themselves? In a classic liberal sneer, the New York Times sniffed that some of Regnery's anti-Clinton books would not, quote, be likely to pass muster at an assembly of scholars. No examples were cited nor evidence adduced for this assertion. Such jeers say no more and are intended to say no more than that the Times disapproves of conservative books. I've just mentioned half a dozen mendacious liberal books. What do they have? Liberals don't believe there is such a thing as fact or truth. Everything is a struggle for power between rival doctrines. They express boundless credulity for the claims of communist regimes. You must admit, Cuba has an excellent healthcare system. They respect totalitarian regimes for their power to enforce the truth at the end of a gun. And they respect the truth in America as it is enforced on the pages of the New York Times. Only a disregard for both market forces and the truth can explain why publishing houses keep rushing liberal hoax books to print while doggedly refusing to publish surprise bestsellers. Unable to compete and running out of book advance money to provide liberals with lifetime sinecures, the left is increasingly desperate to censor conservatives outright. It was easy enough before the internet. Newspaper editors, TV executives, and publishers could simply refuse to hire or publish conservatives. They could jam liberalism down our throats on every television broadcast, morning show, late-night comedy program, and large circulation newspaper and magazine in the country. But the internet has undermined the major media's capacity to enforce a strict party line. It is not a coincidence that conservative books, always strong sellers, have experienced a boom since books became available on the internet. Even the left's precious campaign finance reform can only stop conservatives from buying space in the mainstream media outlets. On the internet, speech is free, and liberalism can't survive the competition. The same relentless competition of the web that annihilated the commercial dot-coms has produced near dominance of the internet by conservatives. In a ranking of the 9 most visited websites in the politics and new media category, conservative sites regularly outnumber liberal sites. Though the rankings vary from month to month, the list for March 2001 is typical. 4 of the 9 are conservative websites: DrudgeReport.com, number 2, Townhall.com, number 4, FreeRepublic.com, number 6, and Reagan.com, number 9. Only 2 are liberal websites, coming in at numbers 5 and 8. Similarly, conservative think tank sites are consistently overrepresented in the top 9 think tank websites. Thus, for December 2000, 6 of the think tank sites were conservative groups, only 1 was liberal. 1 month later, in January 2001, the Conservative Heritage Foundation was number 1, the Libertarian Cato Institute number 2, and Pete DuPont's National Center for Policy Analysis number 4. There were only 2 liberal think tanks in the top 9. The effect of the internet on the left's capacity to shape the truth cannot be exaggerated. Consider a few truths forced into the open by the internet. Newsweek had a tape of an intern discussing her affair with the President of the United States, but the magazine decided to sit on the story that reflected poorly on a Democratic president. Later that night, the story ran on the internet, broken by the Drudge Report. For decades, the New York Times had allowed loose associations between Nazis and Christians to be made in its pages. Statements like these were not uncommon. Quote, "Did the Nazi crimes draw on Christian tradition? The church is co-responsible for the Holocaust. Pope Pius XII, who maintained diplomatic ties with Hitler." And then, out of the blue one day in 2002, the New York Times ran a prominent article describing the Nazis' virulent crusade against Christianity. That very week, evidence from the Nuremberg trials detailing the Nazis' crusade against Christianity had been posted on the internet. After enduring decades of liberal sneering about Star Wars, the Pentagon tested the technology and shot a missile out of the sky at 11:09 p.m. on July 14, 2001. The next day, less than 2 months before a terrorist attack on America, the New York Times ran a major front-page, 2-inch headline, 9,000-word article on the Florida election. The successful dry run of a missile defense system was mentioned in a short item on page 12 of the newspaper of record. It didn't matter. The night before, news of the successful test of Star Wars had been blasted all over the internet. Drudge Report headline moments after the test: "It's a hit." This is why liberals are in a panic about the internet. They believe conservatives should be prevented from speaking. Thus, the same pious blowhards who love to prattle about the sacrosanct First Amendment when the speech at issue is obscene or treasonous are constantly issuing lunatic demands for regulation of America's most dangerous samizdat media, the World Wide Web. Over the years, the New York Times has bemoaned a disappointing Supreme Court decision upholding a local ordinance requiring go-go dancers to wear pasties. It has denounced Mayor Giuliani for, quote, "grossly distorting the First Amendment" by threatening to withdraw taxpayer money from a pornographic exhibit of the Virgin Mary. It has criticized the Child Online Protection Act for requiring credit cards for pornographic websites as a violation of our First Amendment rights. But University of Chicago law professor Cass Sunstein's book, Republic.com, detailing the bright side of censorship, won fulsome praise from the Times. Sunstein had proposed censoring only the internet. The Times is ever vigilant against deft manipulations of the First Amendment to protect the likes of Matt Drudge. Sunstein's book argued that the internet had created the intolerable situation of allowing the reading public choice. As Sunstein darkly put it, consumers are able to see exactly what they want. This must be stopped. His point, in his own words, was that, quote, "a commitment to consumer sovereignty may well compromise political sovereignty." A clearer statement of left-wing fascism is hard to come by. Whose political sovereignty will be compromised exactly? Though Sunstein strained preposterously to suggest that it is not just conservative websites that threaten democracy as we know it, his both sides argument was transparently phony. The dangerous world he imagined consisted of, quote, liberals watching and reading mostly or only liberals, moderates, moderates, conservatives, conservatives, neo-Nazis, neo-Nazis. How precisely would a conservative go about eliminating liberal points of view from his life? You would have to be a survivalist in Idaho to escape the liberal sound chamber. As a start, one would have to cut out public schools, colleges, the evening news, sitcoms, movies, children's cartoons, book reviews, Lifetime TV for women, Katie Couric, Bryant Gumbel, People Magazine, Vanity Fair, and the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, and indeed all major newspapers and magazines. It isn't compartmentalization that liberals are worried about. It is the capacity of Americans to escape the Orwellian drivel. Restricting oneself to only leftist propaganda, day in and day out, simply requires taking no action. Like the mass marketing solicitations advise, you do nothing. Don't tune in to Rush Limbaugh. Don't subscribe to Human Events. Don't seek out conservative websites. But Sunstein's insight that the internet allowed people to limit their exposure to like-minded viewpoints raised a red flag at the New York Times. That's not free speech. It's conservative kooks. The Times was rapt with admiration for the idea of censoring the internet and hailed Sunstein for raising important and troubling questions about the effect of the internet on a democratic society. Unlike child pornography and totally nude dancing, which are the very heart of the First Amendment, the Times noted the internet offers a powerful new weapon to fringe groups and reinforces extremism. In other words, the internet must not be permitted to interrupt important commentary that preserves the political sovereignty of liberalism. With only slightly more subtlety than Professor Sunstein, in 1996, Time magazine noted with alarm that a computer user can, quote, totally customize his or her daily supply of information. This suspect development meant that news was moving away from the universal. The new individualized nature of information, Time said, means news is no longer a common experience. See, that's just the sort of thing conservatives are talking about. The news never was a common experience for people who didn't think Ronald Reagan was a contemptible dunce. If the universal experience of liberal hectoring was not so unpleasant, Americans might not have turned to the samizdat.media with such zeal. Time expressed alarm that news sources now included the likes of Rush Limbaugh and internet websites. MTV was thrown in for cover. Like-minded Americans were meeting and communicating with one another, and not just any Americans. As Time explained, these were paranoid right-wing kooks. If liberals were not already scared out of their wits, the magazine stated that right-wing militia groups, i.e. mainstream conservative chat rooms, were being nourished by their own books, periodicals, and email lists. Though stopping short of Professor Sunstein's call for regulation of the internet, Time did raise questions about what this meant for our understanding of the world around us, for our sense of community. Hillary Clinton has also expressed concern about the accessibility and instantaneous information on the computer. Too much free speech. This was in a press conference on February 11, 1998, or 2 weeks after Matt Drudge broke the Monica Lewinsky story being suppressed by Newsweek. Not surprisingly, Mrs. Clinton raised the need for some kind of editing function or gatekeeping function for the internet. Saying it is just beyond imagination what can be disseminated, Mrs. Clinton said, we are all going to have to rethink how we deal with this. There are, she announced, competing values. To wit, her electoral viability or the First Amendment. So the First Amendment's gotta go. The children need her. Celebrated First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams also never saw the dark underbelly to free speech until the Drudge Report. Abrams was quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying, if one were rewriting libel law today, one would try to write it to assure that the false statements of Matt Drudge were treated as libel. More likely, you'd rewrite the First Amendment to take account of Floyd Abrams' clients. Abrams has defended the false statements of ABC, NBC, Fortune Magazine, Consumer Reports, and political candidates. Matt Drudge evidently cries out for a higher standard of accuracy than every other information source in America. In any event, Drudge seems to be meeting the new special high standard of accuracy reserved for the Drudge Report. His only alleged misstatement that was ever tested in a court of law concerned a statement about Clinton aide Sidney Blumenthal, for which Blumenthal sued Drudge for libel. The case ended with Blumenthal paying Drudge money. A Clinton-appointed federal judge actually made a finding of fact that Drudge is, quote, not a reporter, a journalist, or a news gatherer. Hustler Magazine is journalism protected by the First Amendment. Penthouse and the National Enquirer are journalism protected by the First Amendment. Indeed, even the New York Times is deemed journalism protected by the First Amendment. The dean of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism noted with some consternation that no journalist or journalism organization protested after this federal judge took it upon himself to determine who can be called a journalist. To the contrary, media experts treated Drudge like a cancer that had to be excised so real journalists could get on with the important business of calling Reagan stupid. Joan Connor, publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review, said Drudge is, quote, by no reasonable measure working in the public interest. Marvin Kalb, then head of the Shorenstein Center on the Press at Harvard, dismissed Drudge as, quote, a conveyor of gossipy information. Liberals love the sound of the Supreme Court's ringing peroration. There is no such thing as a false idea. But the moment they are confronted with ideas other than their own, on the internet, on radio, and in books, liberals discover boatloads of false ideas. Not only that, but the competition of other ideas turns out to be nothing but trouble. In a true competition of ideas, it turns out the American people are appalled by theirs. So now they tell us a robust, free, unregulated marketplace of ideas is a threat to democracy. If liberals were prevented from ever again calling Republicans dumb, they would be robbed of half their arguments. To be sure, they would still have racist, fascist, homophobe, ugly, and a few other highly nuanced arguments in the quiver. But the loss of dumb would nearly cripple them. Like clockwork, every consequential Republican to come down the pike is instantly, invariably, always, without exception, called dumb. This is how six-year-olds argue. They call everything stupid. The left's primary argument is the angry reaction of a helpless child deprived of the ability to mount logical counterarguments. Someday we will turn to the New York Times editorial page and find the newspaper of record denouncing President Bush for being a penis head. The "you're stupid" riposte is part of the larger liberal tactic of refusing to engage ideas. Sometimes they evaporate in the middle of an argument and you're left standing alone, arguing with yourself. More often, liberals withdraw figuratively by responding with ludicrous and irrelevant personal attacks. Especially popular are non-sequiturs that are also savagely cruel. A vicious personal smear, they believe, constitutes a clever counter-argument. Your refusal to submit to name-calling means you were overwhelmed by the force of their argument that you are a penis head. George Bush doesn't actually have to be a penis head for some portion of voters to believe, absolutely, without hesitation, that he is a penis head. That's the beauty of controlling all major sources of news dissemination in America. It ensures that liberals will never have to learn how to argue beyond the level of a six-year-old. Indeed, almost all liberal behavioral tropes track the impotent rage of small children. Thus, for example, there is also the popular tactic of repeating some stupid, meaningless phrase a billion times. Arms for hostages, arms for hostages, arms for hostages. It's just about sex, it's just about sex, it's just about sex. Dumb, 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 money in politics, money in politics, money in politics, Enron, Enron, Enron. Nothing repeated with mind-numbing frequency in all major news outlets will not be believed by some members of the populace. It's the permanence of evil. You can't stop it. The power of brainwashing by repetition is powerfully illustrated in the case of the Clarence Thomas-Anita Hill battle. Immediately following the hearings, 69% of women believed Thomas rather than Hill. A Newsweek reporter wrote in the liberal New Republic magazine that, among co-workers who knew both Thomas and Hill, the vote was Thomas, 20-1. But over the course of the next year, Hill was endlessly praised in the mainstream media, showered with dozens of awards, and invited to speak at once prestigious organizations such as Yale Law School and the American Bar Association. Her heroism, and Thomas's perfidy, was flogged on TV sitcoms such as Murphy Brown and Designing Women, the latter ironically produced by Linda Bloodworth Thomason, friend of real sexual harasser Bill Clinton. Hill was made Glamour Magazine's Woman of the Year and featured in a Ted Turner documentary, A Century of Women, with fair and balanced commentary by liberal Senator Barbara Boxer. Needless to say, Hill was sympathetically stroked by Katie Couric on The Today Show. 1 year later, with no new facts, no new hearings, no new evidence, but a lot of media propaganda, only 44% of women believed Thomas over Hill. After watching the hearings, 73% of people said the Senate had treated Hill fairly. 1 year later, only 49% thought so. Repetition alone doesn't win elections, and is demonstrably incapable of producing a twitch of interest in campaign finance reform. But constant liberal browbeating demonstrably can persuade large numbers of people that Republicans are dumb, irrespective of cold, hard facts. Also, angry, mean, intolerant, inflexible, and judgmental, unlike the welcoming charm and noted flexibility of, say, Hillary Clinton. Another infantile trope of the left is to deny the relevance of analogies and categories so you can never trap them. No matter how apt it is, no matter how clearly it exposes the poverty of their logic, liberals always say analogies have changed the subject. We were talking about Paula Jones, so I don't know where Anita Hill came from. Each case must be treated as if it just emerged from the ether, analyzed in a vacuum apart from any conceivable larger principle. Liberals also refuse to acknowledge the meaning of labels, which are nothing more than truths liberals don't like. They especially hate the word liberal. Everyone knows it's an insult to be called a liberal, widely understood to connote a dastardly individual. Consequently, liberals are constantly insisting that the word is utterly meaningless. In contradistinction, evidently, to phrases like right-wing, ultra-conservative, and religious right, which are treated as terms of near-scientific accuracy. Indeed, the surest sign that one is dealing with a liberal is his refusal to grant meaning to the word liberal. The argument that liberal conveys no meaningful information is always stated in terms of the great variation among liberals. There's more variation among dogs than among liberals, but that doesn't mean the word dog has no meaning. No one demands a 20-minute exegesis on the differences between a poodle and a Great Dane before acknowledging that the word dog has meaning. Similarly, there are tall liberals, short liberals, cowardly liberals, even more cowardly liberals, but there is still an essential dogness to all of them. The myth of dumb Republicans permits only one narrow exception. When not defined by their monumental stupidity, Republicans must be scarily weird. The far less popular scarily weird caricature has been applied, for example, to Nixon, Dole, and Gingrich. Liberalism's high priest in the media provided insistent cues that Newt Gingrich was supposed to be portrayed as mean, not dumb. The weirdo caricature was stated most forthrightly in a Newsweek headline that called Gingrich Spiro Agnew with brains. It was also indicated by Time magazine, putting him on their cover as Scrooge. Weeks later, showing the fierce independent thought that dominates liberal discourse in America, Newsweek put him on their cover as the Grinch. The idea was, welfare was Christmas, and Gingrich was trying to steal it. After the Scrooge's welfare reform turned out to be a fabulous success, it became Clinton's initiative, his signature reform, his good idea. So powerful are liberal myths that they often lead to spiritual visions among the media elite. The apocryphal stories typically acquire the status of fact by neurotic repetition in Maureen Dowd columns. Among many other widely accepted apparitions, Attorney General John Ashcroft is absurdly said to fear calico cats, and Dan Quayle was alleged to have apologized to an audience in Latin America for not studying his Latin more. Noticeably, no one could ever seem to produce a videotape of many famous Dan Quayle gaffes. The dumb Republican smart Democrat myth lives in a world devoid of rational thought and logical consistency. It never occurs to anyone to ponder why the Republican Party would pursue such a crazy strategy of consistently running really dumb guys for office, much less president. Or why the Democratic Party insists on tapping presidential candidates who are so mind-bogglingly smart that they can never connect with the average voter. George Herbert Walker Bush, or number 41, was shielded from the dumb argument not by his stellar resume, but by his lightning rod vice president. Liberals cannot fight a two-front war. Consequently, though Bush was portrayed as a simpleton who couldn't talk, the most vicious attacks were trained on Dan Quayle. Whatever you can say about Quayle, he's smarter than Tom Daschle. George Bush, number 43, with degrees from Yale and Harvard, is ridiculed for his stupidity by Hollywood starlets whose course of study is limited to what they've learned from bald, sweaty little men on casting couches. Stupid means one thing, threatening to the interests of the Democratic Party. The more conservative the Republican, the more vicious and hysterical the attacks on his intelligence will be. Liberals have not only run out of arguments, they've run out of adjectives. Consistent with this definition of dumb, the current Republican idiot is always dumber than all the dumb Republicans who preceded him. Bush is dumber than Dan Quayle, who was dumber than Ronald Reagan, who was dumber than Dwight Eisenhower and Calvin Coolidge. Astonishingly, the left's propagandistic purposes have recently demanded even Reagan's rehabilitation in order to attack George W. Bush's intelligence with greater vigor. This is nuance in liberal argumentation, dumb and dumber. College dropout Michael Moore expressed the party line on relative Republican IQs, saying, "Once you settle for a Ronald Reagan, then it's easy to settle for a George Bush. And once you settle for a George Bush, then it's real easy to settle for Bush too. You know, this should be evolution. Instead, it's de-evolution. What's next?" That's easy. What's next is a Republican even dumber than George Bush. But if you can remember what happened the day before yesterday, it never adds up. If the last Republican was the dumbest person in the history of mankind, at some point it becomes metaphysically impossible for the next Republican to keep being even dumber. On the bright side, the constant upgrading of former Republican presidents keeps historians in business. They can always go back and produce shocking new evidence that some previous Republican president, chosen at random, was not a dimwit after all. At least it's nice to know that all Republican presidents will eventually see their IQs skyrocket. Historians have concluded only fairly recently, for example, that both Coolidge and Eisenhower were quite shrewd and perfectly content with the sophistics of their day ridiculing them as idiots. This follows decades of sneering at both presidents for failing to live up to the standards of FDR, who was obviously great because he spent 8 years failing to get the country out of the Depression, but then had the skill and foresight to allow the nation to be taken by surprise at Pearl Harbor. Just before the 2000 election, Slate columnist Robert Wright referred to the recent revisionism on Eisenhower, saying his voluminous personal correspondence shows beyond doubt that he was vastly smarter than either Reagan or Bush. That's an interesting formulation. The only baseline Wright acknowledges is Reagan or Bush. Only Republican presidents are subject to having their intellects questioned. Why not Truman and Kennedy, Eisenhower's immediate predecessor and successor? Truman got the country into a war in Korea and couldn't get us out for 2.5 years. Eisenhower was elected and ended the war in 6 months. Kennedy got the country into a war in Vietnam after the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion, and then sat passively by while the Russians built the Berlin Wall. So how does Eisenhower's intelligence compare with those two guys? It's as if comparisons with a Republican's immediate predecessor and successor are inherently invalid, because it wouldn't be right to comment on the relative competence of a Democrat. The left's single most impressive use of the dumb argument was against Ronald Reagan. Trying to document the widespread belief that Reagan was dumb would be like trying to document a general societal animosity toward the flu. Reagan's stupidity was touted in late-night jokes, Broadway plays, the nation's editorial pages, and morning TV shows. It was pervasive, unquestioned, something all cultured people simply took for granted. A lesser man would have been destroyed by the relentless attacks. More enraging than the media's jibes about Reagan's stupidity were their patronizing expressions of phony concern about Reagan's mental acuity. Reagan supporters were called upon to assure New York Times reporters that Reagan is, quote, not a stupid person at all. As with all liberal smear campaigns, eventually the slur became its own reality. In the 1980 presidential campaign, Jimmy Carter's reported strategy was to portray Reagan as untested, old, dumb, simplistic, an actor, naive, inexperienced, Republican, right-wing, as National Journal reporter Ronald Brownstein put it. When Walter Mondale ran against Reagan 4 years later, Brownstein said the Mondale campaign had dusted off the old Carter list, dropping only the inexperienced charge. Even the New York Times expressed exasperation with Mondale for adopting as his sole debate strategy, calling Ronald Reagan dumb. Shortly after Ronald Reagan won the largest electoral landslide in history, Gore Vidal quipped, "President Reagan's library burned down, both books. The tragedy was he had not finished coloring the books." In contradistinction to the anti-Reagan bile of college dropout Michael Moore, Vidal's remark was at least a joke. It's just that it's always the same joke. In an attack too pointlessly complicated to quote in full here, Richard Cohen of the Washington Post wrote, "Picture Ronald Reagan. Okay, now picture him as a giant knee. He really is a knee-jerk conservative." University professors filled letters to the editor sections with snotty jeers at stupid old Reagan, such as one that referred to the simple-minded pronouncements of Grandpa Reagan. A joke popular with the liberal sect throughout the Reagan years was, "George Washington couldn't tell a lie, Nixon couldn't tell the truth, and Ronald Reagan can't tell the difference." Toward the end of Reagan's amazingly successful second term, American Enterprise Institute's William Schneider authoritatively announced, as Schneider announces all liberal cliches, that the Reagan presidency was 8 years of simple-minded bromides. There was even a Broadway play written by Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury fame, the theme of which was, Reagan is dumb. When the play bombed, the failure was attributed to the Reagan character being too lovable. Throughout the Reagan years, opposition to any administration policy, any policy at all, never had to be explained beyond calling it dumb. Since all sophisticated people knew Reagan was stupid, the proposition that his policies were stupid because he was stupid was, ipso facto, a good argument. Congressman Vin Weber, Republican of Minnesota, objected to Reagan's proposed education cuts by calling the cuts dumb. Representative Henry Gonzalez, Democrat of Texas, said the denial of a visa to Nicaraguan leader Thomas Borge was an example of Reagan showing his mental senility, presumably as opposed to one of those other types of senility. When then-Senator Al Gore was campaigning for president in 1988, he attacked Vice President Bush for supporting some of Reagan's policies that were, quote, unfathomably dumb. Opponents of Reagan's proposal to privatize Amtrak explained that the idea was dumb. New York Mayor Ed Koch said Reagan's plan to eliminate federal mass transit subsidies was, quote, the dumbest thing I've heard of in years. Columnist Mike Royko said that, in the opinion of several hundred of the nation's top scientists, physicists, engineers, mathematicians, and others, Reagan's missile defense system was, quote, a dumb idea. And this is how liberals developed their formidable debating skills. Another classic from the Reagan is dumb genre was an op-ed piece in the Washington Post attacking Reagan for his proposal to disband the Council of Economic Advisers. The article thoughtfully explained, nothing is so downright dumb as the consideration President Reagan is giving to junking the Council of Economic Advisers. All in all, you weren't likely to learn much from the article if your reaction to Reagan's proposal wasn't already, how in God's name are we going to get along without the Council of Economic Advisers? The article included the powerful testimony from one of the two surviving members of the CEA, who strenuously opposed the elimination of his job. But not to lose sight of the main point, the article stressed that Reagan was dumb. His plan to eliminate the invaluable CEA reflected, quote, a more general distaste at the White House for alternative ideas, especially from economists and academics of all kinds. Strictly speaking, this was an alternative idea. Instead of having CEA, old idea, Reagan was going to get rid of it, new idea. But whatever, Reagan's idea of eliminating the CEA was dumb because Reagan was dumb. Foreign dignitaries quickly adapted to the native culture by telling reporters they, too, thought Reagan was dumb. New York Times columnist James Reston wrote that visiting NATO officials had no confidence in President Reagan and questioned his knowledge of the facts. To really drive the point home, Reston noted that the foreign ministers were highly intelligent and make elegant toasts. The elegant toastmasters believed diplomacy is an exercise in compromise, and that compromise is the goal. Reagan, by contrast, thinks it's a struggle between winners and losers. Scaring the wits out of liberals everywhere, Reston reported that Reagan's objective is to win. And then when Reagan did win the Cold War, they said he was lucky. When Reagan was up for a second term in 1984, liberals deftly switched their argument from dumb to senile. Since they always thought Reagan was an idiot, only the finely honed talents of skilled American reporters could detect the subtle distinction between innate stupidity and age-related senility. Without irony, the Washington Post reported, Democrats, usually sensitive about raising the issue, openly suggested that Reagan, 73, was too old to serve another 4 years. Striking a particularly smarmy note, The Economist magazine advised Reagan to think hard before running again. Nothing personal, but he was senile. For reasons having to do with his virtues as much as his manifest faults as a president, The Economist was foursquare against a second term. By hanging on in old age, Mr. Reagan might undermine his legacy more than if he leaves it persuasively behind him now. When Reagan began his spectacularly successful second term, he was 73 years old. A majority of the justices on the Supreme Court were older than he was, including liberal icons William Brennan, 77, Thurgood Marshall, 75, and Harry Blackmun, 75. Yet there was no media hysteria over the senile old guys deciding life and death issues from the Supreme Court, no campaign to get those old coots to hang up their stirrups. Attempting to duck charges of ageism, the media began deploying old people for the Reagan senility watch. Naturally, the New York Times led the way. In June 1984, the paper ran an article by George W. Ball, Under Secretary of State in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Ball, it was duly noted, was 74 years old. In an incredibly creepy column, Ball, who was 74 years old, ran through Reagan's chances of dying during the next 4 years. Apparently, the actuarial tables indicated that Reagan had only a 2/3 chance of living for 4 more years. Becoming increasingly macabre, Ball, who was 74 years old, noted that Reagan's chances were even less if he were re-elected, since in this century, 1/8 of our dead presidents were assassinated. All in all, it was a column that would have provoked a visit from the Secret Service during the Clinton administration. The real hazard, said Ball, who was 74 years old, was not that Reagan would be assassinated, but that he will become ill, senile, or slow in thought and reactions. Frighteningly, he might not be able to surrender to the Soviet Union with the alacrity desired at the New York Times. Ball, who was 74 years old, went on to describe in unseemly detail a paralytic Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson, who functioned only marginally and fitfully and was unable to sign or veto legislation, an appalling amount of which managed to become law anyway. Ball excused Wilson's blithering senility on the grounds that we had just won World War I, fortunately, and the nation was safe from foreign attack. And, happily, the Wilsonian peace lasted until the consequences of Wilson's partition of Germany led like night into day to World War II. But that was different. Wilson was a Democrat. Or as Ball phonily distinguished the cases, now we face an antagonist armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. Citing his own experience as an advisor to President John F. Kennedy when Kennedy almost got us all killed during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Ball wrote, "How could we deal with a Soviet Union whose leaders knew that the only man empowered to push the nuclear button was too ill to think or act decisively?" Of course, if they read the New York Times, Soviet leaders already thought Reagan was too stupid to act decisively. When they weren't running articles by old people relating how they tend to misplace car keys around the house, the media raised the senility issue by reporting on the emergence of an issue. Like other phony liberal concerns, the age issue only was an issue because the blabocracy kept harping on it. Most peculiarly, a spate of general interest articles on senility began to pop up in large circulation magazines. In the 10 months before the 1984 election, Newsweek, Time, Ladies' Home Journal, and U.S. News & World Report all ran major pieces on senility. That's too many to be a coincidence. The LexisNexis archives yield only one magazine article on senility in 1976, zero in 1980, zero in 1988, zero in 1992, one in 1996, and one in the year 2000. In other words, the same number of magazine articles on senility were published in 1984 alone as in all other presidential election years combined in the last quarter of the 20th century. Fortunately, it turned out that 49 states preferred a senile old man to a Democrat. Amid unusually high voter turnout, Reagan was re-elected in the largest electoral college total ever. He went on to end the Soviet Union, preside over a booming economy, and translate his immense popularity with the public into another landslide election for his vice president, who then squandered it all by raising taxes. This is what liberals mean by senile. Years later, the media was still muttering about what a dope Reagan was. On December 27, 1999, NBC's Katie Couric opened the Today Show by chipperly announcing, "The Gipper was an airhead. That's one of the conclusions of a new biography of Ronald Reagan that's drawing a tremendous amount of interest and fire today." She was referring to the recently released Edmund Morris book, Dutch, A Memoir of Ronald Reagan. The next day, Matt Lauer opened the Today Show saying, "Good morning. For the first time, President Bush is responding to the controversial new biography of Ronald Reagan, and, in particular, the author's assertion that Reagan was a great president, but an airhead." After quoting President Bush attacking the airhead characterization as grossly unfair and untrue, Lauer observed that another thing the author seems to say is that the Reagans were not all that crazy about the Bushes. When Morris finally came on the Today Show to respond, he denounced the claim that his book called Reagan an airhead as brutal and grossly unfair. "I did not call him an airhead." Explaining that he had simply written that on a first meeting, Reagan seemed an apparent airhead, Morris observed that the whole course of his book makes quite obvious that the first impression was wrong. To Couric's follow-up question, "So you do not believe today that Ronald Reagan was an airhead?" Morris said, "Oh, good God, no. He was a very bright man." Years after Reagan liquidated Lenin's revolution, biographer Lou Cannon pontificated that Reagan was wonderful about Jack Benny and worthless on the subject of Lenin. Good thing he wasn't wonderful on Lenin, or the Red Army might be goose-stepping through Toronto about now. Summarizing the wildly successful Reagan years, Washington Post reporter Haynes Johnson wrote a book suggesting Reagan had sleepwalked through history, a thesis coyly alluded to in the title of his book, Sleepwalking Through History, America in the Reagan Years. Ponderous windbags wrote earnest book reviews observing that Johnson did not specifically say that Reagan was the one doing the sleepwalking. How about sleazeballing through history, the Clinton years? But as John Kenneth Galbraith admitted in his New York Times review of Johnson's book, Johnson made the case that Reagan was the sleepwalker over and over again. Galbraith pompously added, "This is as it should be." The irrevocable fact that the American people adored Reagan posed a problem for liberals. They had very clearly explained that Reagan was dumb, mean-spirited, frightening, and so on. But still, Americans loved him. Even during the media's nightly flogging of Iran-Contra, Reagan's approval ratings fell only 5 percentage points, from 80% to 75%. This was the biggest ever recorded drop in Reagan's public approval rating. A majority of Americans continued to approve of the job he was doing as president, and 79% of Americans said they like him personally. Eventually, liberals threw in the towel on persuading the public to hate Reagan, and instead trained their hostility on the American people. From the beginning, this had been the logical consequence of the left's attacks on Reagan. The self-appointed party of the people hated the people because the people kept voting for Reagan. A book reviewer for the Washington Post commented on the Reagan era by impotently demanding to know just how dumb, how submissive Americans really are. He speculated that the public was hypnotized by the fluctuations of Reagan's left eyebrow. Citing many observers, Newsday's Jonathan Schell said that during the Reagan era, we Americans, a preposterous conceit, began willfully to deceive ourselves about the world in which we live and about our place in it. Still in a huff about Reagan's triumphant popularity, Schell fumed. A nation that has enclosed itself in a bubble of illusion is at risk of sudden, startling inundations of facts from the real world. Another Republican who failed to meet the exacting IQ standards of the media is President George W. Bush. The image of Bush as an airhead, as the New York Times non-judgmentally put it, has been lovingly nurtured by the media. During the 2000 presidential campaign, the media was issuing daily updates on the Bush intelligence issue, which, as usual, had become an issue solely by virtue of the media's perseverating that it was an issue. In a seething rage that Bush does not defer to important Ivy League intellectuals so treasured at establishment headquarters, the New York Times called Bush determinedly non-intellectual, an anti-intellectualism he has resolutely cultivated. The Washington Post framed the Bush IQ issue this way. Call it a recurring plume of doubt that hangs in the air like cigar smoke, sometimes framed as depth, sometimes intellect, sometimes gravitas. Does George W. Bush have the candle power to be a great president? Is George W. Bush bright enough to steer the country in times of crisis? Is George W. Bush a lightweight? Time magazine elaborated, "The implicit charge is less that he's stupid than that he's incurious, proudly anti-intellectual." This was in contrast to John McCain, who graduated fifth from the bottom of his class at the U.S. Naval Academy, but was beloved by liberals and therefore never had his intellectual curiosity questioned. Liberals' idea of intellectual engagement is Bill Clinton's adolescent cramming in all-night slumber parties, leaving the place littered with pizza rinds and women's panties. Describing Gore's love of complex ideas, Newsweek admiringly observed that his office is strewn with pizza cartons and Diet Coke cans. In a campaign profile of George Bush's college years, the Times quoted numerous real people, including famed Clinton flack Lanny Davis, testifying to Bush's superior intellect. Still, the article repeatedly insinuated that Bush was an idiot by use of the Times' signature unsubstantiated asides. Thus, the Times vaguely referred to conceptual Yale classmates who frowned on Mr. Bush, seeing him as an airhead party boy. Also, the Times reported on impressions that seemed to exist. Few, if any, professors seem to have left a mark on him or he on them. Other evidence that Bush was dumb consisted of his failure to argue with the press about their querulous descriptions of him as dumb. After relentlessly calling Bush stupid, the media began psychoanalyzing his reaction to being called dumb. Time magazine reported, His body tenses. He turns his face forward. His eyes narrow and he gazes out the windshield at the long road ahead. Could it be? He was weary of being asked the same moronic questions about his intelligence. Further probing Bush on the issue of just how dumb he was, the Washington Post reported, "It becomes apparent rather quickly that this is not a comfortable interview and not a comfortable subject for George W. Bush." What precisely is the proper reaction to having one's intelligence questioned a billion times daily? Gore was never asked if he was too dumb. He was, however, asked whether Bush was too dumb. As reported by the AP, Gore, convulsed in laughter while taking a drink of Diet Coke, grabbed a towel to hold against his mouth, then, finally swallowing, insisted the tape recorder be stopped for an off-the-record observation. And then Gore lost to the dumb guy, becoming the first incumbent president or vice president ever to lose a presidential election during peacetime and a good economy. Most preposterously, the New York Times reported, as if it were news, quote, "With his grades and college boards, Mr. Bush might not have been admitted to Yale if he had applied just a few years later." Might not have been admitted? What on earth does that mean? Bush also might not have been admitted if he had dropped out of high school and become a gangster rapper. It so galls Northeastern liberals that Republican George Bush went to an Ivy League school, they can't resist publicly fantasizing about an alternative universe in which Yale rejects him. After having spent months dutifully creating an issue about a Republican's intelligence, nourishing it, protecting it from dissenting opinions, writing about it from this angle and that angle, taking it out and polishing it up again, the press then jumps on the smallest misstatement by a Republican on the grounds that it reinforces impressions. Trading anonymity for instant celebrity, Andy Hiller, political correspondent for WHDH-TV in Boston, sprung a pop quiz on Bush early in the presidential campaign. The reporter demanded that Bush name the leaders of India, Pakistan, Chechnya, and Taiwan. Bush exasperatedly refused to answer two world leader questions, gave the name of one leader, and described another. Inasmuch as this was during the Clinton era, many Americans were frankly relieved at Bush's response, hoping that if we couldn't name their leaders, perhaps they couldn't name ours. The media reacted as if Bush had been unable to locate Canada on a map. To George Stephanopoulos on ABC's Good Morning America, the quiz incident raised an underlying question about Bush's qualifications and suggested Bush was not sure-footed. Quote, "There have been questions about George Bush's experience with foreign policy and his knowledge. He hasn't been sure-footed on foreign policy this campaign. When the war in Kosovo came up, he wasn't sure-footed in his responses. I think his campaign now is going to have a very hard time calming people down about whether Governor Bush is up to this." The pop quiz dominated the talk shows for days, including the Sunday morning political shows and every major newspaper and magazine in the country. Bush was directly questioned about it on ABC's This Week. There was palpable joy on the New York Times op-ed page. In one of literally hundreds of articles on the incident, Time magazine described the pop quiz as a critical moment for Bush. Newsweek reported that the Bush campaign was spin-doctoring madly. The Washington Post uncritically quoted Gore campaign officials, comparing Bush's performance on a meaningless pop quiz to Gore's claim to have invented the internet, not knowing this week's leader of Cameroon was the equivalent of pathological lying. Andy Hiller, the wise-ass local reporter who sprung the pop quiz on Bush, was giddily feted as if he had just invented cold fusion. It was such a galling spectacle that even the New York Times expressed hope that the incident would not tempt other journalists away from a deeper, more probing style of questioning. On the off chance that the public had missed the point, the media quickly sketched out the larger themes. Fascinatingly, these were the exact same themes the press sees with any Republican presidential candidate. First, it reinforced impressions that Bush was dumb, and second, it raised questions about how Bush reacted under fire. Thus, in a typical exegesis on the pop quiz, a Kansas City Star columnist said the pop quiz raised doubts about Bush's most glaring weaknesses. It showed that the frat boy born with a silver spoon still has something to prove. Over at the New York Times, they were mainly upset about Bush's facial expressions. Despite the incredible importance of the facial expression issue, Times columnists gave diametrically opposed descriptions of what Bush's facial expression was. Maureen Dowd wrote,